Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our speaker will be Brenda, and the topic will be skillful means. So welcome, Brenda.
Thank you for joining today. So tonight, wanted to kind of talk about skillful means. When I was a kid, I was into science fiction in middle school, and I came across a book by Robert Heinlein, who, if you like science fiction, might have read at some point. It was called Have Spacesuit Will Travel. And the book starts with a conversation between a boy and his father. And the boy says, "Dad, I want to go to the moon." His father says, "Sure, son." And the son says, "Dad, I said I want to go to the moon." His father said, "I heard you, son. I said that was all right." The son, getting impatient, says, "Yes, Dad, but how?" The dad replies gently, "Why, son, that's your problem." The simple story has come back to me many times at transition points in my life, and I have grown to appreciate its simple wisdom. And I would like to apply it tonight for a continued discussion on the Bodhisattva vow. We talked last month a little bit about working with finding a place of simple intention to help all sentient beings. Tonight, I would like to venture into the yes, but how? So for some of you who might be engineers out there, this might be fun. Buddha called this skillful means. I always found this a little bit puzzling. What is it? What is skillful? What is means? In Sanskrit, the word is upaya. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Maybe somebody can correct me. But meaning, the described meaning is expedient. In Chinese, the word that's used is fangbian, or in Japanese, hoben, which is the reading of those Chinese characters. And its translation in English from the dictionary is something like convenient or expedient. But if you look at the actual characters, they mean it's put on the side. So they're sort of right next to you. They're available. They're something that's convenient, yes, but it's just very available. At hand is probably a good description of that. So, you know, in trying to understand skillful means, what are we measuring? What are we trying to achieve? How do you measure your progress? Marcus Lemonis has a show on TV, if you guys might have had a chance to watch TV lately, called The Prophet, which I've followed over the years. And he when he looks at a failing business, he likes to break down the analysis into three areas: people, process, and product. So people would be, in this case, holding the intention to benefit beings, and skillful means would be the process. The product would be an enlightened person or an enlightened world. Now, wouldn't that be fun? You could make it more complicated, as each of these three would also have skillful means within themselves, but let's keep things simple. So now we have some skills in other areas, like perhaps going to school, making a living, relationships, maybe raising kids for some of us. And for those really lucky ones, being a grandparent. I highly recommend that one. I'm very biased towards it recently. And there too, skillful means are prized in our lives out in the world. And it's necessary to get things done. Maybe we can use some of those skills in this endeavor. Let's just start with making a living. In the workplace, our job is often to make things more efficient, to get a product out, whether that is a concept or a physical product or service. All of our effort goes to figuring out what the problem is, and also, as Columbine mentioned a few weeks ago, to make sure that our work is recognized by peers. Otherwise, we might not have a job at the end of the day. Now, what would it look like if our goal was actually not to get recognized, but to release active forces in other people that might enable them to find their own peace and joy and freedom and bliss? What would that look like? So you see, in a way, perhaps we're using the same apparatus that we have trained so hard over the years to help us at making a living or other purpose and repurposing it for a somewhat different goal. Kind of like GE making ventilators to assist in management of the pandemic. Now, three things I have found paramount in the endeavor to try to interpret what skillful means are. And they are deep listening, gentleness, and adaptation. Deep listening because I may not know the whole story of that other person's experience. And I think this is probably the most important ones. You never really know the whole story, especially in a situation where we haven't spent years together in a monastery. We may not share as many experiences as we would like. We can never really know someone's full story. So it's important to keep an open mind and to ask questions and deep questions. It's important to listen as deeply as we can and understand where they're coming from. Gentleness, in that our words or other intervention that might be aimed at helping someone might in fact be doing the opposite sometimes. If we probe gently and touch, we might be able to figure that out and readjust our approach. Now, this contradicts a little bit the model that we have in Silicon Valley of change. Which somebody has quoted for me as the way for innovation is move fast and break things. That model has not always been the model for innovation. But in the past years, it's been necessary to adopt that due to the intense competition and the need to shorten the time to market and capitalize on the very transient technological advantages of a company. But that might not work in a Buddhist model of change. What would be appropriate for a Buddhist model for change? Maybe something like move slowly and realize that things are fundamentally not broken, so please don't break them. If you can move slow enough, maybe you can make a small adjustment or maybe just get out of the way and make space as things adjust themselves. A few weeks ago, I asked Les during a lecture, how do you know when things need to change? And he answered, go slow. I'll give you an example from my work, from my life. As a physician, I often treat teenagers with various problems. As part of that, we often talk about their diet, exercise, and sleep patterns. Now, if some of you were ever teenagers or might have one, you know that diet, exercise, and sleep in a teenager are all over the place and are not necessarily subject of discussion. But for many years in my medical practice, I plowed on and tried to tell them how to live their lives in my own model, getting very tired and feeling as if I was totally losing them. They would get a glazed look over their face while I left the visit, feeling frustrated, and often little change actually seemed to happen. About 10 years later, I learned a magical technique called motivational interviewing, which some of you may have heard. Now, if you haven't heard this, I recommend you check it out on YouTube. Basically, it states you really can't change anyone. Ah, now we're getting somewhere. I could definitely agree with that. So it suggests that you ask them what they want to achieve and are they achieving it with their current approach? And when you did that, you often found out that the teenagers knew exactly what they were trying to do. And in some cases, the behavior they had chosen was very logical to achieve those ends. For example, some time ago, I had a young man suffering from headaches who was spending several hours each night playing video games. His goal was to become a video game programmer. And as he stated, he needed to get on the games to figure out how and why people made the decisions they make so that he would know how to design the games effectively. The headaches were really sort of a secondary side effect. He didn't like them, but he really wanted to learn how people thought when they were playing video games. So after he shared that with me, we were able to talk about how he could get in his video game time and also find some time to get some meaningful sleep. Was there a middle ground where both aims could be achieved? So you can see that from my previous self, telling him he needed to go to bed earlier would not have led to any change in his behavior because it didn't make sense within his framework. In fact, it would be counter to his best judgment, and he would be correct. Gentleness, checking in or observing the effect one creates, is also quite important. Some time ago, I decided that to be a good wife, I should make elaborate dinners, nice dinners. And what I thought by that was several courses and have it be very complex and beautiful and arranged nicely and so forth. And I would plan these elaborate dinners, take hours to cook them, often running late into the evening, and then sometimes feel very frustrated when my husband would not fully appreciate my efforts. He would care more about the dirty pans than about the wonderful food I had struggled to make after a long day at work. Initially, I thought he was just being rude. Some time later, I found out that he actually has a condition that's called OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. So he was actually right. In his mind, a bunch of dirty pans were much more distressing to him than the wonderful food that I had struggled to prepare. Oh, what a revelation. And what a relief. I didn't have to fix all this complicated food. I just had to put a few simple things together and make sure the pans were cleaned, and he was very happy. So communication is not only about what you are trying to say, but what is the result of what is coming back to you. It can be quite difficult for us to accept that over 50% of communication is out of our control. But it's really also very beautiful because we can relax and realize that it may not be our fault. And then real communication can start to take place. So checking in, our wonderful intervention coming from the heart, may land at the wrong time, may have an unwanted side effect, or in the case of my cooking, may be totally beside the point. So observing the effects one produces can give you a clue as to how it's landing. Then there's the issue of timing. A perfectly good intervention at one time may be totally inappropriate for another. Kind of like a coach might ask a batter to hit the ball harder while asking another to back off a hit or just touch the ball with the bat. Both can be right, but at different times. A line from one of our chants comes to mind. The ancient sages called black as white according to circumstances. So we can relax, try to show up and do our best, and that is good enough for now. Tomorrow we will repeat and persist. That helps to develop our modest effort. And through these successive iterations, we hope that we get closer to an alignment between our intentions and our actual actions and effects that we might hope to produce, and accept that this is an endless task. It can never really be completed. So those are just a few thoughts I had about skillful means, and I will open up for discussion. One of the things I do in my spare time if I can't sleep during COVID is I write little poems. So I'm going to share a little poem with you tonight. Sitting on his rock, overlooking the valley down below, the stonehead, this is a Chinese name for Sekito Kisen, pondered the way to help sentient beings. Sheltering in place, in his grass hut, not worrying about outward success or failure, the weeds growing all around him, becoming a weed himself, Who can say what helps and what doesn't? Only time, and maybe not even that. The roots of suffering buried deep beneath the ground, our own mind weeds, softly changing, waiting for the spring rain to flower into the rose of awakening. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you.
So if anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to come to Gaucho and unmute yourself. Or raise your hand if you're on audio.
No, nobody's had an experience with skillful means.
Wait, actually, three people just came all at once. it was Nick, then Peter, then Les, almost all in a row. So,
okay, Nick.
Thank you. I'll go first. Brenda, thank you so much for the really insightful explanation and demonstration of what exactly skillful means is. And as you were telling your story about when you were first starting in your practice and you weren't particularly applying it with your patients because you were really kind of set in whatever you wanted to get across as, you know, a new doctor, I kind of remembered my first, you know, 1 or 2 years when I first started teaching music. And I remember I was a pretty young, headstrong teacher, and I had my own idea of what I wanted to get across, what I wanted students to take from my lessons. And as a result, I was not perceptive to what my students actually needed. And kind of going back and looking on it, you know, now that I've had many years of experience teaching, I kind of want to go back and apologize to that first group of students that I had and just said, sorry, I failed you as a teacher because I wasn't listening. I wasn't really perceptive to the situation. I didn't apply what needed to be applied. And so my question, I feel like I have a better understanding and cultivation of skillful means in the way I interact with students and the way I interact with other people now. But it really wasn't something I was able to do until I had that experience to teach me. And I look back in school, you know, I took all these courses on psychology, sociology, pedagogy, and I had all these really great theoretical conceptual tools in the toolbox that didn't work. And so my question is how, you know, aside from, you know, cultivating deep listening, aside from cultivating that sense of gentleness, what can we do to learn this skill other than just the experience? Because in this case, those experiences, I did fail those people that depended on me.
Yeah. And I guess I would say that you might think you failed them, but maybe you didn't, because maybe they understood that also about you. I think there's a natural tendency for people to self-correct. So, you know, you have to believe in our own capacity to self-correct. And when we hear something that's not helpful, you know, we don't usually kind of, we sort of set it aside a little bit. You know, we don't like, they're like, oh, okay, maybe I'll find that meaningful later, you know. But so I don't think that necessarily you hurt them, you know. So you have to forgive yourself for that. There's no way to avoid mistakes, I think. There's just no way. It's like riding a bicycle. You're going to fall. And so I think rather than just saying, you know, doing your best, really, that's all you can do, and adjust as you need to, and try to pay attention when you're goofing up, you know, and sometimes what we think are our best intentions later turn out to be goofs, but that's okay. you know, we're all in this together.
And thank you so much, Brenda.
Sure.
Peter, did you want to go?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Brenda. It's a very, very interesting talk and very interesting subject. That's kind of been on my mind lately. So very helpful to hear your thoughts on it. One thing that I've been struggling with lately myself is in my work I'm a manager, and one thing that I often find is really difficult is being in a position where I feel responsible for people and where I feel responsible for helping people understand what their work is, what they can be doing, but most importantly, kind of how they're doing in terms of you know, the company's understanding of what performance is and promotions and performance reviews and compensation and everything like that. And one thing that I kind of hold very dear is you know, taking an approach of first asking a person who might report to me, you know, what their goals are, what they want, what they'd like to be doing with their lives, what they'd like to be doing with their work, and then finding some way to make that happen, find some opportunities to like help them do that in their work. But often the answer is I'd like to get promoted, or I'd like to make more money. And then we run smack into the question of, well, you're not, you know, they might not be doing well enough in order to get that. And sometimes that comes as a surprise to people. Sometimes they argue with me about it. Sometimes they push back on it, and it feels really bad, because it feels like I'm like in the worst way, it feels like it's my responsibility to be judgmental of them, to like sit, and in some ways it actually is. It is to like apply the judgment and standards of the company to their work. And this has just been kind of it was particularly acute recently. I've been having a few conversations around this with a few people, and it's been really weighing on me. And I haven't really been able to find a resolution to it for myself or find a perspective on it or an understanding of it that can help me feel comfortable. I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Thank you, yeah. This is a big responsibility that you have, you know, for these folks who are looking to succeed and feel successful. The only thing that comes to mind is that sometimes there can be a discrepancy between, you know, they don't understand what the metric is. You know, there can be two things. Is, you know, do they understand the metric of success, and are they able to meet it? Are they willing to meet it? Has that been sufficiently explained to them? Because sometimes I think in tech companies and all companies, that may not be explained, you know, and you're like, look, this is what it takes to get promoted, you know, and you can argue with that, but that's kind of what the current game plan is. So, you know, what do you think about that? Is that something that you want to do? And that way, if the person takes it on, maybe between meetings with you, so they meet with you in September and they say, okay, well, by December, company metrics, you reach these kinds of goals, we can talk about a promotion. So I think having a clear set of expectations that are very clearly outlined and the person understands what is involved, I think can be helpful at making it less personal. And also, I think also in your descriptions to the person, your actions with the person, making it very clear that this is not a judgment of their, of them, but rather their performance in the last 6-3 months, you know, according to these criteria. It could be a wonderful person in a different setting, or, you know, that you're really just looking at these criteria, some programming or what progress has been made on a project or what have you. And then I think the other thing is also looking at, do they have the resources that they need to make that kind of progress? Because I think a lot of people are working really hard and they show up and they try, but, you know, do they have the mentorship? Do they have the supervision? Do they have the resources, the data that they need to make that progress? And can that be identified earlier on before that evaluation so that those resources can be made available to them and creating that path of communication with them? You have what you need. This is what you want. You wanted that, you know, I know this is important for you. I want to make sure you get that promotion. We need to see how we get there. Can we do that earlier in the game rather than post hoc?
Thank you.
So, okay, so I think Les and Travis both had a question. Les, would you like to go?
Thank you. So, Brenda, how many patients have you had in all the years that you've been a physician?
Only one.
So who are all these people that you've been meeting with? No, not a trick question. How many people or patients have you had over all these years of being in the medical profession?
I don't know, thousands.
Okay. Can you give us one example or what example jumps to your mind of where you use skillful means to work through some difficulty in a relationship with a patient? Do you have a story for us?
Oh my goodness. I think of what would be a good story for you. So many. I think of today. So be careful because you're not supposed to give a lot of details. Difficulties in my relationship with the patient is what you're kind of asking, right? Difficulty in my relationship. Oh, that's a good, there's a good one. Well, there was a young lady some years ago who had some shoulder pain, and she found that Vicodin was very helpful for her pain, and she was about 10 years old. And in looking at her story, it turned out there were a lot of things going on. One is that she needed some physical therapy. She had a lot of muscle spasm. She had some other medical conditions that made it very, gave her some pain. But I sent her to physical therapy and she couldn't go. And then we tried to figure out, why isn't she going? You know, we told her to go. Then it turned out that the young lady was actually caring for a younger sibling and was basically providing the daycare so mom could go to work. And so once we understood that, we were like, oh, that's what's going on, really what's going on. So she didn't want to tell us this, but it turned out that she was babysitting her younger sibling during the day, and that's why she couldn't go to school and go to physical therapy. So we helped her do all of that, and eventually she went to physical therapy. She was wonderful, wonderful young lady. And but at one point, she still did find having some small number of Vicodin very helpful. And the pharmacy would always give her a hard time when it came to getting the Vicodin. They would refuse her medications and all of this because she was a child. But she was very independent. She had to get herself to the pharmacy because her mom had to work late hours. And so at one point, she calls me up on the phone, leaves a message on the, she's like, Dr. Golianin, she said, I am doing my job. She's about 12 at this point. I am doing my job. I am going to physical therapy and I am going to school. And I need you to do your job. The pharmacy is refusing my Vicodin. So please take care of it. Yeah, so I did, you know, I called the pharmacy and I said, can you please just give the medication? You know, we gave the prescription, what's the deal? And she's actually studying to be a nurse now, the young lady. And she put herself through school and she's a beautiful young woman. So it's a relationship is always a two-way street. You have to, you know, you ask for some things, you know, I want you to go to physical therapy. And she says, I want the medication that helps me to go to physical therapy. So you have to adjust.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Travis?
Thanks for your talk, Brenda.
Thank you.
The part that really stuck in my mind was when you turned from skill building and competence into this question of how would you take utilitarian skills and turn them towards others and unlocking, you know, the potential of others, if that's a fair way of phrasing it. I think there's, you know, you also touched on some of the external standards that we're subjected to in the Silicon Valley, and maybe some of the distinctions with the technical domains with this versus the social world, and how the rules that apply to the technical world sometimes encroach on teams and people. And that gentleness and knowing what's good enough is really critical. I share a lot of the feelings that Peter has when I work, you know, I work in a really results oriented place. And I think you can definitely relate, you know, we have a culture of professionalism, you know, and, you know, to think about what the opposite of that would be, it would be maybe a beginner's mind. And in the Western world, we would say an amateur. That'd be the classic term, right? And we wouldn't necessarily want to be called a dilettante, right? Because that would be a slur. Someone who takes an interest in something without being completely an expert in it, which is a terrible way to set up someone for failure. And maybe a life of joylessness too. I'm wondering about this this what you said about certain models. My question is, you know, there is that analytical model that's very like demanding and exacting, but then there's the like the intuitive aspect of that everyone has in some, to some degree, you know, and in my work, you know, I'm also like leading a small team, and I feel like the team is doing really well, but the tendency is I want to get in there and understand the technical part of it. When really, like, I can really feel when they're doing a good job, when they're getting it done. And I have a feel for, you know, there's a fit there. And so how do we balance those two aspects of ourself in that competitive environment? Because I think of solutions, but solutions maybe on many different, like maybe much more situational, and the model that I apply for a certain situation won't work tomorrow. We say, you know, within Buddhism, we say, you know, Buddha Dharma, and when if you ask me what that is, you know, it's like, it's a good person that speaks the truth, basically. but then you have the Zen masters that say, or this famous kill the Buddha. And I think that, you know, this model making that we do, how have you been able to go beyond that and be able to broaden in both your work and in your life at large?
Great. It's a good question. You know, I think a model is a model, right? It's modeling reality. It isn't reality. And it could be useful. And then you'll also find at the edges, stops being useful, right? And the trick is knowing when you're at the edge of that particular usefulness of that model. And I'd like to kind of go back to what one thing that you said earlier, which is that you're managing the team and you can feel when they're doing well, right? You can feel it. There's something there that's happening that you can, whether it's energy or there's something happening, the problem solving or the interactions, that you can feel that it's happening. How do you know that? Can you tell me a little more about that? What's that like when it's?
I could talk all night about that. It's flowing. They're happy. Everyone else is like, sees the energy. The problem I have is, and this gets me every time, I've had decades of utilitarian indoctrination. Like, if I don't know exactly how it's happening, I lose it. In my work setting, not in other parts of my life, but having it all under wraps it can be somewhat nightmarish to not know how it's happening, but that's only a part of me, right? That's the analytical side. And I think in the Silicon Valley, there's like a sort of schizophrenia, because there has to be that very like keen analysis, strategic thinking. There's politics. But really, like, you know, to think about what Peter said earlier, you know, or, you know, when he was talking about somebody wanting money and prestige, those are other metrics, you know, like, right. Like, right. They're like poor substitutes for a satisfying, you know, you spend a lot of your time at work. So like, when you really like what you do, man, it trumps all that, but your mind is constantly making, evaluations, and I think I think is, you know, I'm getting in a little older and trying to, you know, transition more into leadership. I think, I see it as kind of a split personality, kind of exacerbated by the demands of the workplace.
Yeah, I think it's you know, it's definitely, I think making that transition to from being yourself, the sort of the person who's accomplishing it, to leading a team or kind of overseeing the project is definitely hard. You know, they say, you know, people before things, right? Sort of work with your people, value your relationships. And in the long term, that will pay off. And people, if they feel valued and if they feel like they can come to you with the problem, well, if they trust you, they'll come to you. It's like, you know, this isn't working, or this interaction with this other person isn't working. But I think building those relationships is probably more important. It's more important than the immediate technical detail. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Dave, and then Teresa.
Yeah, thank you, Brenda, for your talk. So I'm going back to what you said a minute ago, Brenda, about it's important to recognize when you come to the edge of the usefulness of a particular model. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier the model, the famous motto, move fast and break things. And I think, at least in the outside world, there's a sort of image of Silicon Valley that is the one and only way that Silicon Valley ever works. That the winners are determined by these sprints, and the first mover advantage always determines everything. I think those of us who work in the Valley know that it's a little more subtle than that. I mean, aside from the fact that it's not particularly good for all of us, for our mental and spiritual health, to constantly be, to see life as a series of sprints, even in terms of the Silicon Valley work experience and the products that come out, it's not really always the right way to proceed. I mean, personally, I've been involved with a handful of projects over the course of my career that had the common theme that we got them done as fast as we possibly could. We got them out to the market. We were too soon, and somebody else came along later and made all the money from the ideas that we worked on so hard. And there were a number of these things. I mean, the first product was mice icons and windows, the first MP3 player that let you carry your whole music library in your pocket, a bunch of other stuff like that. In some cases, it was because we were overrunning the technology. There was a prototype for a thing like Zoom that we did 20 years ago, and the internet just basically couldn't handle it. So it was ahead of the technology. But even some of the products that really were perfectly in sync with the technology at the time, people just weren't ready for them. The market wasn't ready. And so I think even aside from the whole question of whether it's healthy for us, it's a good idea to stand back and you know, as you were saying, contemplate whether the model, don't get tunnel vision and get so stuck on a model that, for example, you have to run as fast as you can and get everything done as quickly as possible, even if it's harmful to you. That's not always the best thing, even just in terms of the work that you're doing and the products you're creating.
Right, absolutely.
A famous saying from Bob Metcalf, which is the great tragedies of Silicon Valley are almost always based on mistaking a clear vision for an imminent reality.
That's great. Yes. I think, you know, it's easy to only look at the winners in the marketplace. And I'm sure there's a whole lot of stories that we haven't, you know, that nobody writes books about. But all the companies and products that almost were, and the reasons why they didn't, you know, work out. And you know, a lot of people who suffered in the process, I'm sure. Thank you.
Teresa?
Brenda, thank you for your talk. For trying to master the art of deep listening, that's a difficult one. I like the story that you told about this person who was trying to work on game development. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, about, you know, deep listening. What helped you most with that? Do you mainly learn with your patients, or how do you develop that skill, and how do you keep working on developing it?
Well, Teresa, you're very good at that, actually. I remember when you did the interviews with all of us, I was very impressed. You would ask very, you know, deep and meaningful questions and really, you know, follow up with another question and listening you were listening very deeply to everything that people were saying. So I guess if I to describe it, I think one of the things is to, you know, to not have an agenda, like to really just show up and to say, you know, I'm just here. I don't have an idea, a specific idea for what we even need to talk about sometimes, and allow people to have the space that they need. And sometimes people don't even know yet what they want to talk about. You know, it comes out in the relationship, right? Like when you're with somebody, it's like hanging out with a friend, right? Like you're getting together with a friend for coffee. You're not really sure what you're going to talk about, right? You know, something comes up. It comes up in the interaction. But being willing to go where it goes, where it needs to go, wherever it needs to go. I think that's being open to let it be what it needs to be, I think. And that could be uncomfortable sometimes, but at the end, I think it's more rewarding. And coming from a caring place, I guess, you know, sort of holding the person, you know, being accepting, non-judgmental, all those things, something like that.
Umar?
Oh. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Umar.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
So lately we've gone through a loss at home, and Lee lost her brother, and we were doing Zoom meetings for the whole week with the entire family. Every day we had Zoom meetings. And one thing that I consistently kept on hearing from all the family members, from Rich's friends and everyone, was that he was a great listener. He would sit there and listen to everybody and anybody that he could, whoever he was sitting with. And he would not forget anything, as if he was mentally taking notes. And he would come and listen. He would sit down with you, listen to you, and not forget. And then he would ask you what happened with what you were doing. And I thought, but he was a psychiatrist too, so he had that sort of ability to sit there and listen to people. And the other thing that people kept on saying was that whatever he did, he took it on full on. He went in all the way in. So he was really devoted to what he was doing. And he was really encouraging. These were the three things that I heard from people and from everyone, from from the grandkids to, I mean, the grandkids were saying that he was terrible at playing basketball. He would just keep on missing hoops, you know, it was just terrible. But that wasn't the point. The point was really that he wanted to spend time with his grandkids, you know. And, you know, Peter and Travis have brought up the whole idea that, you know, the metrics are what really matter. Is how do you want to live your life, and what do you want to do with your life? Money is great. It's a great tool. It's a wonderful thing to have, and the status is a very important thing to have. It's also a great tool to make a difference in the world. And that's what Lee's brother did. But on the other hand, you know, he also would take calls from people who would call him and have a whole sort of session on the phone with, and not charge them anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in all of this that we're talking about, it just brought things back to me full circle. I've been thinking about this for the past week quite a bit, that what really matters in the end is the emotions and the words that we leave behind with other people.
Hmm.
If we leave people behind happy and feeling supported, and we leave them with positive words, in the end, that's all that matters. That we made a difference on a very small scale. We made that difference. And, you know, you were talking about that, and I was thinking, you know, this is what it all comes down to. That there is a deeper meaning to all of this is knowing that we never know. I mean, I still remember when I was working at Best Buy, people would come to me after 6 months ago later and say, you helped me with this or you helped me with that. The customers, I did, okay, thank you. And I would have forgotten about that, you know, but it's, this is what really matters, is if we can just keep that simple thing in mind and be able to follow through with that. Yeah. Progress is just inevitable. It'll keep going, but it's just that, you know, what we can do for each other and for how we touch each other, you know, is an important thing, I think, at least for me.
Yeah. And, you know, it sounds like Lee's brother really took the time to understand what was going on. I mean, he was out there with the kids playing basketball, you know. I'm not sure that when he was missing all those hoops that he was really, you know, trying his hardest. You know, he was taking the time really be with them, you know, and I think that's a big part of it nowadays. Time is short. And
you know, and that's what the kids kept on repeating, and grandpa was terrible at basketball. You know, they're all just laughing. I was like, oh, yeah, but you don't realize that he wanted to spend time with you. That was the most beautiful thing about that whole exchange. And so I think even when you handle patients or help them out, or the manager talks to their, employee, you know, and just listens to them, sometimes just listening to somebody, acknowledging them, is, I think, one of the most important things.
That's good. Thank you. That's I think that's exactly right. That's exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Umar.
Any other questions or comments? Oh, Diane? Yes, go ahead.
I loved your poem Brenda, it would be nice to have a copy of it.
Sure.
And I'm thinking about the skillful means I didn't have as a young mother, as a parent. You know, we don't get any instructions as to how to parent children. And I'm happy that I have the chance now as a grandmother to better know how to communicate with children. I certainly look back at my lack of skillful means as a young parent, and my kids turned out great, but I regret a lot of not spending more time with them and not just enjoying them, being kind of needing to be in charge. And I experienced that when I first became in charge in my unit when I was nursing. And I initially became very authoritarian and wanted to manage everything and fix everything and to do everything that people had complained about the previous manager. And slowly I realized I was creating a lot of tension in the unit and that I needed to just slow down and look at everyone as an individual and see what each of them were contributing and how we could be a team and work together. But it took a lot of time to learn that. And it's not easy when you're working with a lot of different personalities and you're in a very tense kind of situation. So your talk reminded me very much of my skills or lack of them when I was first a young parent and then when I first was in a manager's position. So thank you. But I'd love to have a copy of your poem.
Sure. I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
And I do think, you know, it's inevitable. I think a few people have mentioned, you know, being young Nick's story about being a young, you know, teacher as well. And I think it's inevitable that we're going to bring in experience, you know, and I think that when, just like we're compassionate with other people and they're making mistakes, we also have to be compassionate with ourselves and realize that, you know, there's no way to run before you walk. And that, you know, part of learning from our own mistakes is being able to be compassionate with our mistakes and mm-hmm. realizing that we're gonna screw up. It's always gonna look incomplete when you look in the back rear view mirror, right? You know, there's always things you could have done better. It's inevitable. That's the definition of it. And so I think being okay with that, being compassionate with that, and realizing that, you know, we're always kind of doing the best we can at any given time. We're all doing that, you know. So
thank you.
Any final comments or questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Brenda, for this amazing talk. I definitely could relate with it in my own work life very much. So I have a lot to think about.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.